Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. This week was a strange week for Tour de Peace. I injured my tailbone in an unbiking-related accident, and we were dodging tornadoes and other severe weather. But today we find ourselves right outside of St. Louis, Missouri, and we're going to join a anti-Monsanto march. Monsanto, of course, is one of the most evil companies, corporations on the planet, and they must be stopped. So I didn't have time to record a new show, but today I'm going to present an interview that I did with my friend Eric Dreitzer, and he has a podcast at the Boiling Frogs, Sybil Edmonds blog or website. And of course, I'm sorry, her name is Sybil Edmonds, and she was on my show a couple of months ago. So stay tuned, and this is an interview that Eric Dreitzer from Stop Imperialism did with me also a couple months ago. Enjoy.
My name is Eric Dreitzer, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. This week, I had the wonderful opportunity to sit and speak with Cindy Sheehan. Cindy is, of course, well known to most listeners of this program. She is a world-renowned peace activist, someone who came to embody, to symbolize resistance and commitment to justice during the Bush administration years. And in the time since then, she's sort of fallen a little bit out of the spotlight. And I think what's interesting about that is that it is far more of a reflection on the so-called alternative media and the foundation-funded Voices for Peace than it is a reflection on Cindy herself. Cindy has not stopped. Simply the media has stopped paying attention. Cindy is very much still committed to publicizing the cause of peace and arguing against imperialism, against the United States war machine, against Wall Street, and against all of the things that I think we all are against. Cindy Sheehan has come to be someone who I respect for so many reasons, not the least of which is what she's gone through as a human being, as a mother, but also for the fact that she has really kind of come to symbolize this political evolution that a lot of people have had to go through, particularly since the onset of the Bush years. There are many people, Cindy, I think, would certainly admit that she's one of them, who did not fully comprehend the corruption and complete control that is exerted over the so-called political process in this country. But considering her experiences, considering how much attention she got, how many politicians tried to use her, how many propagandists and public figures got their picture taken with her for the publicity and for the PR, despite all of that, Cindy continues on her journey, continues on this crusade to really kind of, forcefully demand an end to these wars. There's no other way to say it. You know, it seems almost silly that I would have to go through all of that. Cindy is, in many ways, someone who should be world famous, known by everyone, even those not necessarily politically minded, and yet she is still marginalized to a large degree. She has a following, she has a very dedicated following, but those are the people who have stuck by her. Most have fallen by the wayside. Most have gone the way of, the foundation-funded so-called alternative media who used her and then shunned her and then attempted to kind of distance themselves from her. As the Obama administration has played out and as Obama has shown himself to be Every bit Bush is equal in the warmongering department. Well, that has made Cindy's position all that much more unpopular, as she has spoken out against Obama just as forcefully as she spoke out against Bush, speaking condemning Obama's drone wars and Obama's secret wars and his torture and his imperialist agenda in Libya and so forth. Condemning all of that has in many ways made Cindy a pariah to a lot of these controlled media outlets. And I think that, more than anything else, is what makes Cindy so heroic. Somebody who is unwilling to compromise. Somebody who has never bought into any of the BS that surrounded the media hoopla, even from the very beginning. She is somebody who demands peace. She is somebody who rejects propaganda, who rejects the lies. And so, well, the episode named itself. So that's probably enough from me. I present to you my conversation with Cindy Sheehan. This is The Reality Principle on Boiling Frogs. Thanks so much for listening. Please enjoy. Principle here on Boiling Frogs and to stopimperialism.com, wherever you may be listening. I have the wonderful pleasure of speaking with Cindy Sheehan today. Cindy is, of course, a well-known and well-respected peace activist. She is also a very talented author and somebody who I follow very regularly. And so, again, I'm very happy to welcome Cindy Sheehan to The Reality Principle. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Eric. It's nice to talk to you again.
So since we're somewhat limited on time, I want to get right into it. You know, probably the most significant news of, well, the last few months, if not quite longer than that, was the sad passing of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And, you know, you're one of the very few people that had a chance to go to Venezuela and to actually meet with President Chavez and to get a glimpse into who he was, both as a political figure, but also as a human being. So maybe you could relate your experiences in meeting Hugo Chavez and what people should know about him.
Well, it's amazing to me that there's so much misinformation and propaganda. Well, it's not really amazing. It's kind of predictable. Hugo Chavez was a champion of the poor, and the poor and disadvantaged all over the world, not just in Venezuela. And you know, people who pay attention know that. I have an experience of him, of being able to be with him for extensive periods of time. You know, he's not like our politicians. When you meet with them, they act like, you know, they're already thinking about appointments they have coming up and not about the people who they're talking to right there and then. But also the people that are meeting with our politicians usually are there with cash and promises of, you know, ill-gotten gains and things like that. So, Hugo Chavez was a very, personable person. You could tell that he cared about people. He cared about you. He cared about your issue. He was always fully present in the meetings that I had with him. He was just a very likable person, because, you know, you always tend to like people who you believe like you. And, you know, he radiated that love, not just for humanity, but for each individual. And so he was very charismatic, very funny, you know, just a really likable, nice person. And he had this burning desire to improve the lives of the people of his country, and he sacrificed a lot for it. Even before he got sick, he was a tireless worker, you know, working, not getting enough rest and not getting enough exercise. And so we don't know. There's a lot of talk, of course, that his cancer was deliberate, you know, given to him from the empire. But of course, all the sacrifice he was making for the people of Venezuela, I'm sure, compromised his immune system too. And, you know, it's just like you're trying so hard to take care of others, you don't take care of yourself. And I know how that is. I've tried to balance out my life since I almost died back in 2006. So, you know, that's my personal experience of him. He always warmly welcomed me to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. He always told me that their country was my country, and my son was their son. And, you know, it just, he just had a way of making everybody feel very special.
Yeah, and I think that you're pointing to something that, you know, his supporters have pointed to all along since his rise to power, well, his reemergence as the leader of Venezuela in 1999, and that is that Hugo Chavez was genuine. Hugo Chavez was real. He wasn't some fake cardboard cutout like a Capriles, you know, in Venezuela, or like any of our politicians here. That he was a real guy, and I think that that's kind of what you're also pointing to.
Well, you know, that's the thing. He was a genuine person. He made mistakes. He acknowledged his mistakes. He didn't try to blame other people when he made a mistake. And if he made a promise, that was his focus, was keeping that promise. And so in Venezuela, people didn't think, you know, he was, and by extension, members of his party were making empty promises. And here in the United States, you know, even people who aren't politically aware know that our politicians just make empty promises to get elected, and then they abandon us. So it was a situation in Venezuela where the people felt very engaged and very needed by their government to help make a better life. It wasn't like Hugo Chavez went in and said, this is what I'm going to do. I heard recently that he was an autocrat and, you know, things like that. He was not like that. He convinced the people, you know, the people rewrote the Constitution and said, this is what we want. And so Hugo Chavez was busy trying to implement the new constitution, but he also knew he had to get the people on his side. He had to get the people supporting the changes and supporting him. And that's what happened. I mean, he did have a couple of failures, mm-hmm. but he would go back to the people. And he would, he thought that that was his job, you know, not to blame other people, but to go back and to convince the people that, you know, they needed a victory together. And it was always about everybody, not about Hugo Chavez. And that's what even people on the so-called left here in this country think, you know, that the revolution was all about Hugo Chavez. And now that Hugo Chavez is dead, the revolution is dead. But could be nothing farther from the truth.
Well, and it's to that point that what they failed to realize, and I would say they deliberately failed to realize this, that the Bolivarian Revolution was not your typical kind of revolution, that it was a revolution indeed, but that it was also a revolution that was becoming institutionalized, that part of the undertaking that Chavez was going through for the last 6, 7, 8 years was to kind of institutionalize it into the bedrock of the country, so that once he was gone, that the Bolivarian Revolution would continue. And I mean, that is the lingo, the phrase, you know, pa'lante, va pa'lante, meaning continuing to move forward.
Right, exactly. And Even when Capriles was running against him last year, he even made promises to the people that the social programs wouldn't be discontinued mm-hmm. if he won, because even Capriles knows that. Capriles knows that no matter how many millions of dollars the U.S. dumps into the opposition in Venezuela, whether it be political opposition, social opposition, the U.S. funds many so-called NGOs mm-hmm. there that try to overthrow the revolution, and of course the media. So Capriles knows no matter how these forces are arrayed against Chavez and the revolution, that the people aren't going back. They're not going back to 15 years ago when they were uneducated, they didn't have health care, when they were desperately poor and disempowered. The people are empowered now, and that's what the people here in the United States, no matter what political persuasion you are, that's what the people here fail to understand, because here in the United States, we really don't understand that kind of people power. And so that's what people need to understand about Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution.
I agree completely. And in fact, on my program, you know, the program that I did following President Chavez's death, I actually wrestled with the idea of, you know, really writing some kind of a eulogy and reading that for the sake of posterity. And then I thought to myself that I almost felt like that would have been an injustice. And so instead of simply, you know, waxing poetic about Chavez, what I did was I felt like I eulogized him by running through his accomplishments, you know, focusing uh-huh. on poverty exactly. reduction. How many houses did he build? How many water systems were refurbished? How many poor people got access to education? What did the infant mortality rate become? All of these things, these are the legacy of Hugo Chavez, not simply, you know, his anti-imperialist rhetoric, which is, of course, refreshing, but what he mm-hmm. did for the people, not to mention the people of Latin America who looked at Chavez as a regional leader, as their man.
Well, and, you know, exactly, and that's what people hear. They want to focus on, especially the corporate media, want to focus on his anti-imperialist rhetoric and not his accomplishments. But I want to honor his life by, you know, first of all, setting the record straight. And that's why I wrote my book, Revolution, a Love Story. Back even before he got sick, I wrote that book. But I also am planning on running for governor here in California. And I want to, and that's in 2014, and I want to run my campaign based on that idea of the Bolivarian Revolution and inspiring people, and this is what Hugo Chavez was so brilliant at, inspiring people, poor people, people who had been disenfranchised, people who had been disempowered, inspiring people to realize that they do have the power. And I'm coming from a place before my son was killed where I thought I didn't have any power. And I know that that is wrong now. I know that it's only the people that really have the true power for change. And so that's how I want to honor his life, by trying to recreate this idea of people power here in the United States. I don't know if we can do it by the whole country, but we could probably do it community by community and state by state.
Yeah, and I think that that's absolutely critical. It's focusing down at the local level, the community level, but also expanding that out. I mean, that was one of the central principles of the Bolivarian Revolution. And, you know, you mentioned how one of these media talking points discussing how, you know, Chavez was such an autocrat, indeed, such an autocrat who won 15 elections in the time that mm-hmm. he was president, who's presided over an electoral system that is universally recognized as one of the best, if not the best in the world in terms of its integrity.
Well, this is another thing. I was reading an article where this woman in charge of, I guess, Latin America at the State Department, I don't even know her name and I don't care, because she's just another one of those, you know, mouthpieces for empire. She questioned the integrity of the Venezuelan elections. And I have probably no doubt that she knows that the elections in Venezuela are the most, you know, legitimate ones in the entire world. I know she knows that, so why did she say it? She wants to start casting doubt on the special election next month. That's what she wants to do. And, of course, already they're already bringing out the guns against Nicolas Maduro, who is another personal friend of mine, and it's just amazing it just really angers me, you know, that they think that they can get away with such transparent propaganda, but they think they can get away with it because 99% of the time they do get away with it. And that's why we have to keep calling them out no matter what. We just can't let that stuff rest, because Venezuela is a country in South America, but Venezuela should be, and the Bolivarian Revolution should be, this shining light, this path that we can follow to, you know, a true, healthy society. And it can be done, but we have to fight these dark forces that are lying against us. And one of the reasons that Chavez is so demonized, not just because, you know, he made our oil companies pay their fair share, but because he is this threat of a good example.
Mm-hmm.
We can follow that good example. You know, the ruling class here in the United States, they don't want people to know that they do have power. They want people to feel beaten down and depressed and frustrated and, you know, hopeless. That's why I think the hope and change thing was so effective, because we usually feel effective because we usually feel so hopeless here in the United States. But we don't have to. We don't have to feel hopeless. We can put our hopes in each other and in and ideas that are really good and really healthy and really positive. And the people here in the ruling class, they don't want us to know that.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, I couldn't agree more about what you said regarding Chavez as being an example. You know, that was something that I focused on when I was talking about this on my show as well. And, you know, if anybody doubts that, we're not talking about just an example in some kind of an abstract sense. The reality is, without Chavez, there is no Correa, there is no Morales, there is no Ortega, there is no Alba Alliance. None of these things would exist if it weren't for Chavez. And all of those countries and the leaders of those countries and the ALBA group in general, this is what's bringing Latin America together. It really is moving in the direction of fulfilling the promise of Simón Bolívar. And so by any measure, one would have to say that Chavez was incredibly successful in achieving some of the loftiest goals perhaps in the history of the Western world.
Well, and I also want to say there was this like glaring example of this that most people missed, and that was at the last Organization of American States meeting in Colombia. And of course it was in Bogota, right?
Bogota or Cartagena, I think.
One of those.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I think Cartagena, I think you're right.
Yeah.
We are focusing on it over here because some of our Secret Service agents got busted for hiring prostitutes and then not paying them. And so that's all the focus. But these Organization of American States meetings have always excluded Cuba on the demand of the United States. And so Chavez was the first one to say that Cuba needs to be included in these meetings, and he was the lone voice. And then, of course, like you said, he inspired all those other leaders. All those other leaders came in saying we need to include Cuba. And this time at the Organization of American States meeting, every single country that was there except the United States and Canada, even Colombia, which is, as you know, our best friend in Latin America, said, if Cuba is not included next time, we're going to boycott the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like an enormously significant event that just kind of flew under the radar, because of the, you know, isn't that like a coincidence?
Right.
This big scandal about the Secret Service, service agents when Latin America effectively staged a boycott of the United States.
That's right. And, you know, what you're pointing to is you're exactly right that and this episode also would not be possible. It's not just Chavez's leadership in and of itself, encouraging countries to kind of pull themselves out of the orbit of the United States, but Chavez created parallel institutions that could serve as substitutes
yeah.
for the U.S.-dominated ones. And so you wouldn't have a rebellion within the Organization of American States were it not for ALBA and CELAC and UNASUR
right.
and, you know, all of these groupings that Chavez spearheaded.
Right, exactly. And I was in Venezuela just days after the meeting in Mexico City where they decided to start implementing CELAC, and Chavez was telling me about it. I was very excited about it. And he said it was only for, I remember this so clearly, he said it's only for countries in South America and the Caribbean. I said, well, then why did you include Mexico? Because Mexico's in North America. And he laughed and he said, we consider Mexico part of South America. So I said, okay, well, you know, you're so amazing. You can change the geography and draw the lines wherever you want them to be drawn.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. You know, Venezuela, one other thing I want to say about this too, people forget that Chavez did not come into power as radical, quote unquote radical, as he was later in his tenure, that there were, experiences that he had that helped to shape a new worldview while he was in power. That's something that is very, very rare. And, we remember back to the attempted coup against him in 2002. This is something that I think a lot of people remember and know about. But one other event that happened the following year that most people don't seem to remember is the opposition-backed, U.S.-funded strike against the oil company, the oil workers. And
yeah.
Chavez, this essentially was an attempt to destroy the Venezuelan economy, and it did, and it was incredibly successful at doing that. If you look at the statistics of unemployment and all of the other things between 2001 and 2003, they go through the roof. But it wasn't a failure of Chavez. It was the fact that the opposition had forced this massive strike. But my point is, what did he do in response? Did he capitulate to the United States? Did he capitulate to the opposition? No. He said, screw you, we're nationalizing the way what we should have done all along.
Uh-huh. Right. Brilliant. I mean, brilliant moves. And that's what consolidated his leadership for we see, and this is why you said he's so real and our politics are so fake. When we're looking at the budget crisis we have here, the manufactured budget crisis we have here in the
yes,
United
exactly.
States, and the fight in Washington, D.C., where the Democrats are going, oh, poor Obama, you know, he has to capitulate to the Republicans, or they're blaming the Republicans for the budget crisis and saying that the Democrats are cowardly for capitulating to the Republicans, when, you know, we both know that it's just a big show
mm-hmm.
to do what both parties want to do. They want to pander to the ruling class, and they both want to get Social Security and Medicare, but they feel like they have to put on this big show first. And Chavez was not about that. You know, he was about creative solutions, implementing them, and going forward.
That's right. You know, and Venezuela is now, I think, in a very difficult period, a very difficult moment for them historically. I think that it's quite obvious, or at least it should be, that Nicolas Maduro will be elected as long as there isn't some kind of like incredible electoral sabotage or something else that happens. But we do know that the Bolivarian Revolution is under an imperialist assault. It has been since the very beginning, and I think that right now, there are many of these dark forces that are thinking this is the moment when it's at its weakest. And so you see Capriles and the opposition, you know, jetting off in the middle of the night to Miami and to Washington and coming back with all of this money, all of these strategists. And it's not going to work, at least not right now. But my question for you is, given the fact that we know that the United States and the empire simply won't quit, to what degree do you think this period is an incredibly dangerous one? And do you think that the Bolivarian Revolution is going to make it through?
Yes, I absolutely think that it's going to survive. And I see the government, you know, the revolutionaries, I see that they're, I think that they're handling all of the attacks very well. They're also not afraid to state the obvious that, you know, the U.S. would like nothing more than the revolution to fail now. I don't know if the U.S. is making, I'm talking about the government, is making the same fatal mistake that most people are making, that Chavez was the revolution. And so I think that it is going to continue because, like I said before, the people aren't going to go back. You know, the people won't go back to 15 years ago. I've met them and I've spent time in their community councils, and these people are so energized because they have taken their lives into their own hands. And they have gotten the education and the tools to do that. And they have the tools now. And I don't know how they can be taken away from them. So I think that the revolution will live. And what we owe, and what I said about Hugo Chavez in my book, is that, you know, we owe at least an honest telling of the story. And so that's what we need to keep on doing, is to tell the truth about the Bolivarian Revolution, and do it in a way that really gets people here in the United States thinking that what a different society that we could have.
That's right, and the only other thing I would add to that is that that this period that we're seeing beginning right now, this is simply a new phase of the revolution. Every revolution is met by the forces of counter-revolution. Chavez was
right
there to defeat the forces of counter-revolution, but now that he's not there, it is part of the revolutionary struggle to put down the forces of counter-revolution, to put down the forces of imperialism and neoliberal capitalism, and to enshrine what Chavez did for 100 years and more.
Well, and what you said is so important, is the revolution is now institutionalized.
Yeah, you know, to ingrain it in the people, to take indigenous communities which have never had any rights, have never had any voice, and then to tell them you have a right to clean drinking water and to healthcare and to education and all of these other things, and then they live with that reality for 10, 15 years, and then someone else comes along and tries to take away those rights, you will have full-scale civil war in that country. Those people are not going under the thumb of the Northerners anymore.
Well, and we've seen them rise up even under more oppressive governments. And so I'm getting feedback now. Do you hear that?
No.
Oh, okay. We've seen the people in Venezuela rise up, and I think that they're even more empowered now. And it would be dangerous to try and take that away from them.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a break because I have a couple of other things that I want to talk about, and I know we're a little crunched for time. So on the other side of the break here with Cindy Sheehan on The Reality Principle, I'm Eric Dreitzer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be right back.
You have to lose.
Welcome back to The Reality Principle. I'm chatting here with Cindy Sheehan, and, you know, we could have probably talked for hours and hours about Hugo Chavez and Venezuela, but I do want to get your take on a couple of other things before you go. You know, one of the central issues that I deal with on my show pretty much week in and week out is the conflict in Syria. And what I refer to that conflict as, I don't like the way that the mainstream media and all of these so-called alternative media outlets refer to it as a quote-unquote a civil war. It is not exactly a civil war. It is an imperialist aggression against a sovereign state. That's the way that I've described it. But I want to get your take on what's happening in Syria and the distinction between calling it a civil war and calling it an imperialist aggression.
I believe that the U.S. and the U.S.'s allies are funding the so-called Free Syrian Army, and I was just invited to Syria to go April 28th to the 30th to Damascus for a peace and democracy conference. And so I kept on trying to ask the organizers, who's paying for it? Because they said that they'd pay my way. And I was like, well, who's going to pay my way? Mm-hmm. I want to know who's paying my way. And they finally told me, and it was an organization that was founded by a man who admits getting money from the United States. Mm-hmm. And the EU to overthrow the government of Assad. So I said, yeah, there's no way I can attend this conference. And this man's in exile. He's not even going to be there, you know. So again, the imperialists, the establishment, whatever you want to call them, are so transparent. It looks like they have a playbook. And they say, we want Syria. So let's go back through all of our documents and our propaganda. Let's erase the name of Gaddafi and put in Assad. And let's erase the name of Libya and put in Syria. And we only have to change the first three words on Libya, first three letters on Libya and Syria. It's just really transparent. And another very transparent thing that, now, I don't know how people in the corporate media can even reconcile this stuff within themselves. I don't know how they can live with themselves. They must be completely conscienceless. But Obama was in Israel, I believe, and he said that the red line for him would be if Assad uses chemical weapons. Well, right away, chemical weapons were used. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that they were used by the so-called Free Syrian Army, and that the CIA had been teaching them
yes.
how to use them. Well, actually, the CIA was supposed to be teaching them how to disarm chemical
right.
weapons.
Exactly.
But I believe they were teaching them how to use chemical weapons.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. This one thing I love about you, Cindy, you know more than 99.99999% of all of the so-called experts. That's exactly right. We have documented reports in mainstream media going back to last December where we have American but also European so-called military contractors, independent contractors on the ground in Jordan, teaching them how to, you know, quote-unquote secure the chemical weapons as if they're so afraid that Assad is going to use them. And what's so interesting about that is exactly as you mentioned this week, Obama goes to Israel, but where does he go to announce that they will now openly fund and arm the opposition? To Jordan, standing next to King Abdullah, saying that. And Jordan, of course, understands what the situation is, that they really have two very bad options, and they're going with the imperialist option, thinking that it's going to save their skin in the end.
Right. And, you know, I wasn't able to follow Obama's trip to Israel that closely, but everybody is telling me, you have to look at his speech, you have to look at his speech. So I'm going to have to, you know, take some time to look at it and analyze it. I just know that it was a nightmare for the Palestinian people and, you know, the people of Gaza who have been trapped in this open-air concentration camp for years now. And the thing is the rest of the world knows what's going on. It's just people here in the United States that are so propagandized against the Palestinian people again. You know, it's just like, yeah, Chavez. They just transfer their rhetoric to a whole group of people or an ideology. You know, now they've been very successful at demonizing ideologies mm-hmm. like communism and terrorism and things like that. So it's just really, it's just very transparent, and we just have to help the people see. We have to help the people shift their thinking.
Yes.
Because people might read that and go, oh, the CIA would never do anything like that. You know, the CIA would never train people how to use chemical weapons. Or, like people have been telling me, oh, we wouldn't give Chavez cancer. The United States wouldn't give Chavez cancer. I'm like, look, go back to 2002. We tried to murder him.
Or do we need to run? or do we need to run down the long list of leaders like Chavez that have been assassinated
Hello?
By the United States?
I just had William Bloom on my own podcast, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. He has a list of since World War II, I think he said 86 world leaders that we either did murder, depose, or tried to.
Yeah, and what's funny about that is that, I mean, I haven't looked at his list, so I shouldn't speak out of school necessarily, but
right.
That kind of a number is really just heads of state. Let's forget about all of the social movement leaders, forget all
right,
of the
exactly.
labor leaders, and I mean,
labor
we're talking
leaders.
About thousands of religious figures, thousands upon thousands upon thousands just since World War II.
Well, and that's another thing. I mean, I'm going to, like, change the subject a little bit. But when the OAS was in the Organization of American States meeting was in Cartagena, I didn't see one corporate media story about how being in Colombia is the most dangerous place for labor activists right now.
Mm-hmm.
They're being murdered right and left. And, you know, there's no story about that. And why are leaders of countries gathering in such a place? You know, there's no exposition of those kinds of things
mm-hmm.
in our corporate media. You know, they want to talk about what good friends Colombia is to the United States, what a good friend Israel is to the United States, and we need such a great friend in the region. And they never mention that most of the conflict is because that great friend of ours is there
mm-hmm.
With their stockpile of hundreds of nuclear weapons and their willingness and history of you know, being paranoid colonialists there. So it's just really, I'm just so happy we have places like the Boiling Frog and, you know, Sabel and Herd Journalists and, you know, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox and all the other independent media we have that, I think we are really making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we're really making a difference. We just need to have a wider audience.
Yeah, well, that's and you know, it's a perfect segue into the question I wanted to ask you next, and that is, well, what is this audience? And what I mean by that is that you've talked about Libya. That's, of course, near and dear, I think, to both of our hearts, but also about Syria. And what you see in these examples is the so-called, and I'm vigorously air-quoting, alternative media that has really continued to feed the lies of this
yeah.
of this NATO-created narrative
about
what's happening.
Democracy? Democracy Now?
Right. Well, Democracy Now! Is one of them, but I mean, we could run down the list, Free Speech, you know, Free Speech News, and, you know, Link TV and all of the other ones. And Al Jazeera, for God's sake, you know.
Oh gosh, yeah.
So what you're seeing is that, at least from our perspective, I think, all of these news outlets have really kind of outed themselves with these examples, but there is still a tremendous majority of the so-called left and those who are in opposition to imperialism who are still buying in to the alternative media and particularly the narrative about the Arab Spring, trying to conflate Bahrain, where you have a legitimate struggle for democratic rights, with Syria, which is a manufactured civil war created by the United States. So I want you to speak to this issue about the controlled alternative media and the way in which they shape the worldviews of those people who used to stand next to us at the protests.
Well, what I have noticed is that, you know, Al Jazeera is the most recent example of a media outlet that does a lot of good things and builds a lot of credibility. And so the credibility it builds is, so it's hard to find where the shift in that credibility changes. And I don't know if I'm explaining it right.
No, absolutely.
But I think the Al Jazeera shift came during the Arab Spring.
Yes, it did.
You know, I was writing editorials for Al Jazeera, and they paid very well. They were paying me, I think, like $750 per editorial. And once the Arab Spring happened, I couldn't even get my editor to answer any emails from me anymore. And I saw how their coverage became very, like you said, U.S., NATO, establishment propaganda. And, you know, that was a personal example to me. I think Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Spent years building up this credibility on the left, to where when Obama came in, I spoke on a panel with Amy, and it was just shortly after his inauguration, and she was just like, she's very eloquent with her written speeches, and she was saying, oh, Obama is a fulfillment of Lincoln, and, you know, he took the train from Illinois. And the fulfillment of Lincoln is not a good thing to me. From Illinois to D.C. and blah, 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 on and on. And I was just like, wow, you know, that's when I think I saw the subtle shift in credibility, you know, in Amy, which it probably could have been happening a long time ago, because, you know, people who are concerned with Palestinian rights and 9/11 truth, you know, said that Amy has been a, you know, an operative on those things for a long time. But then, you know, you look and she gets money from these foundations that are linked to the, and this isn't like prop, this isn't conspiracy theory, this is public record. You know, she gets
just
money
from. Just look at the end of every episode.
Council of Foreign Relations linked people, you know. So anyway, so they built up this credibility, you know, with so many people, and it's like the people who won't move from their corporate media propaganda. A lot of people won't move from like the Al Jazeera, Democracy Now! Kind of more subtle. It's more subtle, but it's there.
Yeah, it's a more complex form of propaganda, more sophisticated form of propaganda, but propaganda nonetheless. And, you know, I want to just mention here too that, it was funny because I kind of viciously attacked Democracy Now! Regarding Libya and now Syria since I started my show, and speaking publicly on it. But what I wanted to say though is that what you see is that there's so many people who, are looking to these, to the Democracy Nows of the world and thinking that they're still part of something that they're not a part of anymore. The anti-war movement during the Bush administration was something that was, even difficult to, if I were trying to explain it to a child who wasn't there for that, I couldn't even do it. Like now we struggle to turn out, 100, 200 people to an anti-war protest, where before.
Yeah, if we're lucky.
Yeah, right, exactly.
If we're lucky, we'll get 200 people.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. exactly. Where before, you could turn out 100, 200,000 people. And so even Obama himself is simply a more sophisticated form of social, political, economic control. And, you know, the disappearance, the dissolution of the anti-war movement is exactly what you were just talking about with regard to the alternative media. When the foundations control movements and control information, you will never be able to mount effective resistance.
Well, when Bush was president, I was on Democracy Now! So many times, you know, and Amy even used me for fundraising for Democracy Now! But since Obama's been president, I've been on it once for like 80 seconds. And it was because people were shaming her into covering the anti-war movement. And we had a protest there in front of the White House on the anniversary in 2010. It must have been the 7th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And that's when I had my camp out now at the lawn of the Washington Memorial. I didn't get to talk about that. I got to talk about the protest the following day. But I was cut off in the middle of my sentence. You know, and I got up early and went down to the studio to be on the show, and I was able to be on it for like 80 seconds.
Yeah, you know, and I think that it's one of the ways in which they're able to stifle dissent in this country. I mean, they look at you, they understand that you're a leader by virtue of your actions and that people will gravitate to you. And so you're exactly the kind of voice that has to be silenced. But the way that they silence you is by not simply shunning you, because then that gives you something new to talk about. Instead, give you just a little bit of airtime and then say, oh, we've paid lip service to the anti-war movement. Let's move on and talk about how Obama's so great.
Well, I think, you know, 80 seconds in over 4 years is kind of shunning.
Yeah,
I think that it's not, you know, it's not exactly even lip service. But, yeah, it's really pitiful. And, you know, I know Amy's done good things, for example, on Bradley Manning. There's not been very many places that cover her, cover Bradley Manning's case at all. But
yeah, and you know, I mean, the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, Occupy Sandy, what happened to Rockaway Beach, you know, I mean, Democracy Now!, and I could tell you, I live here, I was there firsthand. Democracy Now! Uh-huh. Was the only news outlet that actually covered Rockaway and the projects and what was happening to the poor living on the coastline. So, you know, we give her credit, you know, where it's
bag.
Deserved.
It's definitely a mixed bag.
Right,
but,
exactly.
But her doing that good lends credibility
exactly.
to the times when she's terrible.
That's
and
right.
Libya, her I don't want to say coverage because it wasn't exactly coverage, but the airtime that they devoted to Libya was despicable.
Yes. Absolutely.
And that's the only word for it.
Made them cheerleaders for imperialism. And if that didn't, you know, Libya was so great as a litmus test, you know, I mean, it really exposed the people who are the fakers.
Uh-huh.
You know,
oh, absolutely. And I'm going to have to go.
Yeah.
But I just want to say I put the support or lack of support to Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez is my red line, you know, trying to use the rhetoric of Obama. People who lie about Chavez and don't recognize the power of the revolution fall on one side of the line. And people who recognize the power, even though we might recognize some of the limitations of what happened in Venezuela, they're on the good side mm-hmm. of the line. And that's my red line.
Absolutely. And it is for me as well. And I know you have to go, but before you do, can you just very quickly tell people the journey that you're about to go on, where people can find information and how they can get involved and about your show?
Okay. What's the date today? The 23rd. In 12 days, I'm going to start a cross country bike ride from my town here in Vacaville, California. We're going to begin it at my son's gravesite on April 4th, the day he was tragically and needlessly killed in Iraq. We're going to ride bikes across the country, stopping in 90 different towns along the way, trying to do what we've been talking about, inspire dissent and inspire not just dissent, but I think you have to have also positive solutions and things that people can do right today. You know, the empire might collapse tomorrow. I mean, it's not very tenuous. So we have to be doing things where we're going to be protected from that. And we're going to end up in Washington, D.C. on July 3rd. We're going to present a list of demands to the White House. We're hoping that we're going to have a great convergence there. We're hoping we're going to have great energy and events along the way. We already have many, many planned. If people want more information about that, they can go to tourthepeace.org, T-O-U-R-D-E, peace.org. That's the name of the bike ride, Tour de Peace. And my show, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, my podcast and my blog and, you know, all the other things I'm doing is at CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
Just so people know, I'm a supporter of Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I get the, you know, I'm on the mailing list and everything, and I think that everyone needs to be a part of that as well. You know, for all of those people who used Cindy Sheehan and then abandoned her, there are many, many more who need to gravitate towards her. And I think that I would also say that I will be in Washington early July, and I'll be participating in that as well. So hopefully people will be coming out to that and, you know, coming together to start building or rebuilding something.
Thank you so much, Eric. It was so great to talk to you again. See you in 3 months and 12 days.
Absolutely. Thank you once again, Cindy Sheehan.
That's the show for today. I hope you go to Eric's blog, Eric's podcast. I will, of course, link that at my blog and at my newsletter so everybody can go. He does also have some amazing guests on his podcast. And, of course, he's a bright and a very articulate young man. And sorry for mispronouncing Sibel Edmonds' name earlier, but I do this on the fly, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I don't have an engineer or producer tapping on the window when I make mistakes, telling me to correct them. So we have to be self-corrected here. Anyway, I'd like to thank, speaking of engineers, I do have one in New York who puts my show together, and his name is Don DeBar. So I'd like to thank Don DeBar of Community Progressive Radio for helping me keep Cindy Sheehan Soapbox going. I'd like to thank my producer, Mikey, Eric Dreitzer, for interviewing me. And most of all, and always, I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. So go to tourtopeace.org to find out where we are, our progress on the Tour to Peace. And, of course, you've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Peace out for now.